All right, you click play. It's that time. You get to hear me and my great guest, Ernie Johnson, from TNT's Inside the NBA. That's coming up in a second. But just a great interview. Really selfless guy. Deep, funny, great stories. You're going to enjoy it. But anyway, I got a few things that are on my mind. I was reading the other day that says something that said knowledge is power. Nah, I don't think so. Because when you're young, you're like 17, 18, 19, 20, you think there are no obstacles in life because generally, assuming you come from, you know, a decent family and you haven't had a hard time growing up, you get pretty much what you want. You set your goals, you achieve them. There are bumps in the road. You think, oh, life's like that. So you go, hey, I'm 20. You know, I think I want to be president of the United States. And you really, in your mind, think, oh, I can do that. I can be president. But then once you get out of school and you're in the real world, you realize there's a lot of stuff getting in your way all the time, and life doesn't work out the way you plan. So you're 20 thinking I could be president, and you're 40 like, I just want it to not hurt when I pee. Like, you change your expectations, that's all I'm saying, you know. The Last Supper had to be tense. Did you ever think about that? I mean, you know, it's dinner. You want to make conversation. Maybe because I'm Italian, there's a lot of talking at the table. I mean, what are you going to chit-chat about? It's Jesus, you know what's going to happen. It's awkward. Like, I'd have a knot in my stomach. What are you going to make small talk about? Oh, this is some hummus, Jesus. Oh, yes, I know. It's sort of the best we've had in years. You know, oh, those are great sandals. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I got them at L.L. Bean. Like, what do you, I don't, I'd be complaining. Fish again? Come on, we get it. You can multiply fish. It just, I don't know how you eat. I'd have a knot in my stomach. I think MMA is just sweaty men kicking and screaming their way out of the closet. It just, it's, you know, it feels that way. I don't know if I told this story already. I apologize, but people want to create controversy when there is none. It really annoys me. There was this, we're walking in Central Park, had a dog on a leash, and you're supposed to have your dog on a leash in New York, and there was a guy who didn't have his dog on his leash, and the dog seemed pretty aggressive. So we were very nice. We said, sir, your dog's supposed to be on a leash. And he goes, why? Because it's a pit bull? Like, implying like we were racist toward pit bulls or something. Like, this is where we are in 2017. Everything's got to be have some double entendre meaning. No, not because he's a pit bull. It's because it's, I said, because it's got a baby in its mouth. That's why. Okay? Maybe that's an indication your dog is a little aggressive. Okay? He's using the baby's chew toy and the baby as a chew toy. I got in a fight over chicken parmesan. You know, if you've been listening, I tend to sort of get in confrontations with people, especially in consumer situations when I feel like I'm getting, you know, the shaft. So I go to this pizzeria near my apartment and I get a chicken parm sandwich. And I'm waiting, and it's like 25 minutes for a chicken parm sandwich. And I'm like, what are you doing? I don't, is someone plucking the chicken back there? Are you like making the cheese from scratch? What are you, are you picking the wheat to make the dough, to make the roll that the, what is going on? Well, you know, we're busy, this and that. He finally comes out with a sandwich. I go, look, can I have an extra small container of tomato sauce? He goes, that'll be 50 cents. And I snap, and I go, you're going to charge me 50 cents for tomato sauce that costs you like 3 cents, and you made me wait 20 minutes, 25 minutes. I go, I'll tell you what, you know what would be good business is to give me not just the little cup of tomato sauce, give me like an entire can of tomato sauce. Give me a farm, buy me a farm of tomatoes. Then I would be happy. Now, I don't want the chicken parm. You can have it. And I walk out. I go two blocks down to another place. I ask for chicken parm. They make the chicken parm. I get it. I open it, and it's veal parm. And I go, I don't want this. It's veal parm. I ask for chicken parm. He goes, veal, chicken, it's the same thing. I go, no, it's not the same thing. It's not. It's they're two completely different animals. They don't look alike. There's no clucking involved in with regard to the other animal. So just give me my chicken parm. He goes, sorry, you know, it's the same. And he wouldn't give me a chicken parm. So I went, like, the whole day, and I didn't get to have a chicken parm. And I didn't have any tomato sauce, and it's the story of my life. But I think I made a point, and I think after that, people will think twice before trying to charge somebody 50 cents for tomato sauce or trying to pass off chicken as veal. I wasn't born yesterday. All right, so those are a few things on my mind, and please enjoy this podcast. with Ernie Johnson, and he's just a fantastic guy, and you're really going to enjoy this. And if you want to have any thoughts you want to send to me, go to my website, paulmercurio.com, and you can. There's a link there. You can send me an email. It says Contact Paul under the Contact section, and send me an email, and I will talk about it on the air, the next broadcast. So it's paulmercurio.com, and just check out, click Contacts, and send me an email, and we will chat about whatever you want to talk about. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy Ernie Johnson. I am very, very excited to have someone that I've admired, looked up to, been entertained by, as well as my son, the great sports broadcaster and journalist Ernie Johnson, three-time Sports Emmy Award winner and host of TNT's Inside the NBA, which is, in my opinion, the best show on television, and I'm not just saying that. And welcome, Ernie. It's great to have you on the show.
Paul, thanks a lot, man. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
I got to tell you, Ernie also hosts Fan Night and CBS's NCAA Division I Men's Championship coverage. But I got to tell you, what you and the Jet and Barkley and Shaq do, my son and I, that is like appointment television for us. I work on a TV show. I have on several, but like, you guys have some captured magic in a bottle, and I assume you know that, but it's information, but you figured out the essence of broadcasting, which is to bring out the core of who you are, and it's just wonderful.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I think, you know, you say that I realize that I know we have something special, Paul. I mean, it's, and I've been around long enough to know that you can't just wish these things into existence and or do a bunch of research and say this guy will work perfectly with this guy and this guy, let's put them together. It's such an inexact science, but somehow working with Kenny and Shaq and Chuck has, you know, it's been a long run, especially for Charles and Shaq for the last five or six, but there's no way to predict chemistry. There's no way to predict what's going to work, but we just all legitimately like each other. Nobody's trying to dominate the show, and we just want the show to be good, and we just kind of hit on a letter rip kind of formula, unrehearsed and unscripted, and it's resonated with basketball fans.
Yeah, you know, and what you've grown into and become as a broadcaster, you know, starting back at the University of Georgia when you. As you like to say, you walked on to the baseball team and then walked off, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah, I was told to walk off. Yeah.
Hey, here's the door. Don't let it hit you in the rear end on the way out.
Yeah, exactly.
And your dad, a great ball player, and played in on the Milwaukee Braves team that beat the Yankees in, for the championship in 1950. And then you got to hang with him when he was a broadcaster himself for the Braves. And you would have like conversations as a kid with like Hank Aaron. My God, what was that like? Like, that must have been amazing.
No, it was Paul, it was a great way to grow up. I mean, I was the youngest of my parents' three children. I have two older sisters, and so right. I was born in 56. The Braves won the series in 57, so I don't remember much about that. But most of my growing up was around the ballpark, especially after my dad had retired and become a broadcaster. And so when he'd go down to the stadium down here in Atlanta to call games, and you know, he'd on the weekends especially, you know, he'd say, hey, you want to go down to the park, and I would just tag along with him. And so we're there at the ballpark 5-6 hours before the first pitch, and so I'm there for every minute of batting practice, and I'm hanging around the cage, and I'm talking to Hank Aaron and Phil Niekro and all these guys, you know. Wow. And it was tremendous. And so, you know, as a kid who loved baseball, you know, that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to do what my dad did. And again, as you point out, I walked on at Georgia and then was told to walk off. And so then you have to make a real life decision and say, what are you going to do? And I was kind of like, I'll be an English teacher and a baseball coach.
Right.
And then, you know, once you try broadcasting, you know, it's like, you know, my dad didn't push me that direction. Skip Carey's the guy who was kind of like, "Hey, Ernie, you got a good voice. You love sports. You ought to give this a try." And then when you start getting into games for free and going to the locker room and telling stories about games, you're kind of like, "Yeah, I'm kind of hooked on this."
Yeah, your dad. I want to talk about your book, and you have a really terrific memoir, "The Unscripted: The Unpredictable Moments That Make Life Extraordinary." That's out now and available on Amazon and all places where books are sold. And it's an autobiography, and you talk about, you say, we're also focused on sticking to the script from one day to the next, one meeting to the next, that we blow right by the unscripted moments that can profoundly impact not just our lives, but also the lives of those with whom we share the planet. And we have to not fear the unscripted, but embrace it. And you seem to, in reading the book, came to that realization over time and, your life experiences. But, like, you say you have to be present and have to be on the lookout because these moments can pop up at any time. And my thinking is, I have trouble doing that. How, when life is so busy, especially in your case, you have children and career and everything else, how do you stay attentive to that?
You have to be intentional, and I think for the longest time, especially early in my career, Paul, I think folks can relate to this. You get so career driven and job driven, and you're trying to take the next step and climb the ladder, and everything's about you. And but I just think that I've seen through the years that even when you're at work, sometimes there's somebody in the hallway who just needs 3 minutes of your time. Mm. They're going through a tough time, and if you're barreling right past people and only paying attention to what you're doing, you can really make a profound impact. And I've tried to take that from as a way of life, not just at work, but at home, and it's the same thing here. Sometimes your kids need you, and you're too focused on what you have to do next.
Right.
When all they want is 2 minutes of you going out to play catch, or just looking at a coloring book with them, or reading them a book at bedtime. All those things, to me, are just vital. Of putting somebody else first,
yeah,
rather than yourself. And I think when you expand that out into the real world, I mean, that's just having your antenna up wherever you go, whether that's, helping somebody out at the grocery store, at the QT, or holding a door open, and I see that a lot with a child who's in a wheelchair that, sometimes I'll be struggling trying to get him into some place, and I see 7 or 8 people standing around who could have helped and didn't do it.
Right.
It's like we really just need to have our antenna up and be trying to look at people at our lives and saying, what can I do for you today? Not what are you going to do for me?
Yeah. Well, you came to this realization and, kind of faith in God, you say December 10th, 1977. And,
1997.
Yeah. And Kevin Myers was giving a sermon at a church called Crossroads and asked, are you pursuing happiness, not wholeness? And you talk about back then, and I really relate to this because to be frank, this is kind of where I am. You're the provider, and you're pursuing happiness, not wholeness. I was living a performance-driven life. My identity was tied to what I did. You might as well have put TNT next to my name. Now, I'm a performer, on-camera person in this business. It's very hard not to have life be about you all the time. But you had this sort of come-to-Jesus moment, if you will, where you realized that there was something more in 97 in that moment, and then you had lunch with him and you prayed over lunch. And talk about that a little bit, because it's fascinating just generally, but it really is a place where I'm hoping to get to in my own life.
Yeah, well, it was one of these things, Paul, where my life was going great. I mean, I'm not going to kid you. I mean, we had 4 kids. I have this wonderful wife, I had a great job. I mean, and I really hadn't paid God any attention. I mean, it was like ever since my childhood, I grew up a Catholic and an altar boy, and then, And then you get away to college and you're in Athens, Georgia at UGA and you're discovering that Sunday morning is really for sleeping off Saturday night. It's not for getting up and putting your church clothes on. You know, this is
right.
And that freedom kind of made me drift for years and years and years. And then it's just one of these moments where you're just kind of saying, is life only what I'm making of it? Or is there maybe a bigger plan at work here that I could be tapping into and should be tapping into? And that was really, when Kevin was speaking at that church, and, you know, this is us going to church for the first time in 20 years, basically. And I'm saying, well, church has changed a lot. And it's, but his message was just one of real present day relevance to me. And I said, yeah, there's got to be a way that's better than mine. And that was really the turning point for me just to say, look, I'm not in charge here. I know there's a God and it's not me. But and so
did you feel
it changed my path? Yeah.
Did you feel that there was something missing consciously in your life at that point? Because like you say, and what I've read, like everything was going swimmingly. Like it wasn't sort of a bump in the road for you, really, so to speak. But so what was it that day that just opened your eyes up?
Well, it just really wasn't, it wasn't as satisfying, I don't think, as it could be. When I looked at it and said, I've got all these things, why do I feel this empty spot? And I think that's what it was. I was filling all that stuff with material things and that kind of deal and saying, what am I going to buy next? That'll put me in a better mood it was just a variety of things that kind of left me saying, what am I missing out on here? And then, and it was really that realization then that I wasn't trying to be a whole person at that point. I was trying to be a happy person and things were not making me happy. And so it was really that kind of a realization matter of fact, kind of conversations with Kevin at that point who pointed me in that direction. All of a sudden I'm sitting here at the age of, what was I, 41 or something at the time. And I'm kind of like, okay, let me dust off the Bible that I've never read. And because I said, it's irrelevant and it has no modern day, meaning for me. And I was totally wrong on that. And I found that to be a roadmap, people say, well, how can you believe that? And I said, look, it's not a history book, man. It's a love letter from God to his kids. And I said, and I'm in. Mm. And so December 10th, 1997, that was the marking day for me.
Wow. And yeah, you say, once I got my foot off the accelerator and enjoyed and focused more on being a dad, husband, work became better and I became better at my job. And that to me is antithetical. I can't get my head around, like, I think, I'm where you were before December 10th, 1997, to be frank. I have a wife, I have a kid, but I'll wake up thinking about what I got to do, what I didn't get, what I got to get, where I got to be. I got a meeting. Everything's riding on this meeting, like all of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I've started meditating recently, actually. A lot of people have been recommending that to me, and that's helped a bit. But it's very hard to get out of my head. And how do you become better at you're notorious for being having an incredible work ethic. You have 3-ring binders and index cards and you prepare like no. And I know you got mad at Charles one time in a commercial break when he tore up your cards. And,
oh man, I was ready to go at it, man.
Yeah, you froze him. Ernie froze him out of the next segment because what he thought was a prank, he tore up his cards and these index cards. And I understand. I think I'm kind of like you. I over prepare, whatever. And that's your roadmap, as you said. And you got so mad at you wouldn't let Charles speak for a segment, which was awesome.
But what else was I going to do? Look, I'm not going to swing on Chuck, and I'm not going to, we're not going to have a bench clearing brawl here in the middle of a show. So the best way I could do that was just to ignore him in the next segment. And Kenny's the instigator. He's the one who's like, I bet you wouldn't tear up his car. I bet you wouldn't tear up that next segment. And I was like, Kenny, what are you doing, man? You're just stirring it up. And Chuck was not going to back down from a dare like that. And he reaches over and rips him up in the commercial break. So, that's the one and only time that's happened. I think Chuck realized how how that, you know, that was kind of a slap in the face at my preparation for the show, and I didn't like it.
Yeah.
But you know, to the point you were making, too, and you know what, I meditation for you, it's prayer for me. You know, that's what it is. I mean, for me, there's a lot of time. I just, you know, when things are getting that crazy, I just need to step away. And I just know, you know, and I spend a lot of time in prayer, and just, and my whole mantra is trust God, period. You know, it's not, that came out of a cancer battle that I had in 03 and 06 when I had treatment, Paul, you know, and I'm kind of saying, you know, why me? Why did this happen? And that.
Well,
kind
I was
of
just
going
to say that, not to interrupt you, but here's a guy that you're selfless. Your wife goes to Romania. We have to adopt this boy. You adopt Michael who has MS. It's an amazing story. You've adopted other children. And don't you turn around in 2003, you get diagnosed with
non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Yeah, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And you say, doesn't part of you go, well, screw you, God. I'm a good guy. Why are you doing this to me? How do you not become bitter and angry at that moment?
Kevin and I, you know, Kevin Myers, my pastor, and I, you know, we sat down at a Starbucks right after I was diagnosed. And I, you know, I'm sitting here and I told him, I said, look, I feel like punching God in the nose right now. I said, you know, look what, you know, look at our family, look at what we're trying to do. And he said, look, 6 years ago, this is 2003, so he goes back to 97. He says, look, 6 years ago, you trusted him with your life. So what's that trust look like right now? Mm. He says, does it look like I'll trust if the next test comes back the way I want it to? I'll trust when this happens? Or is it trust God, period? And that's where we landed the plane. And I was, and that's really where I live my life. And I see everything, you know, through this, the lens of my faith. I'm not, you know, it's not, you know, to make an analogy, it's not, you know, it's like if you had a pie and you sliced it up, it's not like I have a broadcaster slice and I have the dad slice and I have the religion slice, if you were. My faith is at the crust of all of that. Mm-hmm. And so you can't cut a piece out of my life without including my faith in it. So that's really been the way I've gone about it, and I see everything in my life that way. If we're struggling with my son Michael, who's had some really serious health struggles through the years, you know, I have to go back to that trust, and so that's, you know, and that's where I live, and so for me, from one day to the next, and even when things get really, really busy, you know, and I know what you're talking about in the next meeting, and this is important and that's important, I've been able to turn that all over, and, you know, and my prayer life gets even more intense as things get crazier. It's like, you know, give me the wisdom, give me the calm, give me the, you know, to get through this, you know, find me an extra hour in there, will you, where I can get this done without feeling too strapped. You know, it's kind of the way it is.
Yeah. You talked about being at March Madness, and that there's a book, Jesus Calling, that you tap into. Is that right? That sort of has,
yeah,
that's a good,
well, it, yeah, I tap into that a lot. It's, and actually I got a copy of that when I was going through chemo, in 06, you know, somebody reached out, what's so amazing about going through an experience like that is the different kind of encouragement you get, you know, and it's, you know, people taking time out to hit the send button on their computer just to try to do that, or they send you something. And yeah, somebody had sent me a copy of that book, and it's like a daily devotional. And there were a few that I have around that I read, I've used that. I was reading it before a March, yeah, as you said, before one of these long days in the studio during March Madness. I took it on the road with me in New York, and I just read it, that the one for that day I read, and it was just perfect for that day. It was, hey, don't be afraid to laugh at yourself, relax, and not everything has to be white knuckle. And so, yeah, I'm, that's where I, You know, that's where I live. And it's amazing to me, Paul, that we're even having this discussion, because if this were 1996 and you and I were on the phone like this, this conversation would never take this tone.
Yeah.
I would never have seen myself as a guy who would say that the faith is the foundation of my existence. It's just not where I was back then. And thankfully, you know, God didn't shut the door on me and said, "Hey, time's up. You know, you didn't. You know, you're 40 now. You're done." And so really, was a life changing episode at, you know, at the age of 41 that set the course for the rest of my life. And so, yeah, that's where that comes from. Even in the busiest of our work times.
Well, you know, you don't wear it on your sleeve. I mean, Charles Barkley said. He says, you know how some religious people are annoying and a pain in the ass? They beat you in the head with a Bible all the time. Ernie has his religion, but he doesn't bug you with it. And I mean, I know you made some in terms of Trump, once he was elected, you talked about it. And I thought it was one of the best things that was said in the moment, because the night of the election, The Late Show, we did a live show on Showtime because we were preempted by CBS. And, you know, everybody in the studio was like, hey, you know, this is a slam dunk. She gets elected. The broadcast starts. It's 11 o'clock. She's down by 30 electoral votes. It's 135 to 130, something like that. She'll come back. She'll get Ohio, Pennsylvania. She's like, Ohio goes for Trump. Pennsylvania goes for Trump. Like by 40 minutes into the broadcast, he's so far ahead. And then North Carolina falls for Trump. It was like the blood rushed out of everybody's face, and they all walked out. It was like watching like a scene from Night of the Living Dead. They're just all bumping into each other like, what the hell just happened? And so I thought it was really great the way you sort of put this whole his election in perspective. And there are people listening who voted for him, and God bless you, you do what you do, but you don't wear it on your sleeve, which is really impressive, because I know people who do, and that can definitely be off-putting.
No, it's one of those things, Paul, that's because I've been on the other side of that too, you know, and there used to be, again, this is pre-97, there was no bigger turnoff for me than somebody who was in my face trying to convert me or tell me, do you know if you died right now, where are you going? It was so off-putting for me.
Yeah.
And to me, the whole key to sharing your faith is being invested in somebody else's life. And if it naturally gravitates toward a question about, well, Ernie, you went through that stuff, so how did you remain hopeful? Mm. How did you remain positive? You know, then it's like a discussion point. Well, I say, well, my faith was really big in it, but I'm, you know, I'm not going to get on our basketball show and say, okay, you know, we got the Bucks and the Clippers coming up, so everybody open up to Romans 8 and let's dive in. This is not, you know, that's not why they're watching it. But in the case of the election, it was such a monumental moment in our nation's history. I mean, everybody in the country and everybody in the world was talking about this, and I knew that, you know, given the way our show works, you know, we've never shied away from talking about what everybody else is talking about. Sometimes there are things that are happening in the world that are more important than basketball, believe it or not. And so we've talked social issues, we've talked race, we've talked Ferguson, you name it.
Yeah.
And so we knew we were going to be talking about the election. And the question for me that day, on that Thursday before we went on the air, is what am I going to do with my 2 minutes? Am I gonna play it really safe and say, oh, what a surprise, I hope it all works out, good night, everybody? Or I said, or am I going to? And it was like, I think I built up enough equity after 27 years in that chair that folks kind of know me, and then it's, you know, that I feel like I can be honest with these viewers, and that was really the thrust of what I said. That look, and I know it created a lot of talk, you know, and what was gratifying to me is that it was overwhelmingly positive. I mean, our social media group came to me and with all these numbers and all the reaction and all the approve or disapprove and all that stuff, and it was overwhelmingly positive. But I think what I said was some stuff that some people were were thinking but didn't have the platform to do it. And again, that was one of those where, you know, I talked about that pie and my faith being the crust of it. Look, the only way I processed that election was through the lens of my faith, is that, look, there, no matter who's elected president, in my mind, there's what matters is who's on the throne, okay? And so this election didn't happen when God had his back turned and was out getting a bagel, you know? And he turned around and said, whoa, he won? Really? I had no idea.
Boy, I take a five-minute break and the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was really the whole genesis of what I had to say. And it was basically three parts, you know, that I didn't like the choices. You know, I said I had written in John Kasich, you know, and people say, I don't care about your politics, or you're wrong, or, you know, you're to blame. And look, all I could do was what in my heart I could do. And I think the country's too great to have to settle and say, well, I'm not going to vote for this guy, so I'd better vote for the other. I don't like that feeling.
Yeah.
And again, the whole foundation of it was, look, I don't know who's going to be in the Oval Office, but I know who's on the throne. And I didn't want to hit people over the head with the fact that I'm a Christian, but I think I just wanted to say, look, and the way I put it, look, I'm a Christian. I follow this guy named Jesus. You might have heard of him. I'm supposed to pray for our leaders, and I'm supposed to love, and that's what I'm doing. And so it was quite a night. And then a couple of mornings later, my wife and I are at the kitchen table, and she's got Facebook open, and she's looking at pictures of the grandkids. And then she said, geez, Ernie, that thing you said about the election the other night's got 15 million views on Facebook. I said, anytime in a 2-minute span that you talk about Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and Jesus Christ, people are going to yap about it. That's for sure.
Those are the three big headliners in Vegas this week. But the thing is, you're right about sports, and I think it was proper because I my son loves sports, plays baseball. My wife and I grew up in Rhode Island. He was born in New York. He was born into a Red Sox family. He doesn't have a choice in the matter. And just took him to the Ortiz retirement game, which was really wonderfully done.
Yeah.
And sports has a... Now, we go to church. I usher in my church. My son goes to church pretty regularly. But I'll be frank. Sports has the biggest impact on my son and has for a number of years, more than anything else. He'll watch you guys. He'll watch ESPN. He'll watch HBO, Showtime Sports. He just loves sports. And sports can be a metaphor for life, as we know.
Sure.
And so I do think there's a big intersection of sports and the rest of our lives. And to sort of pretend that it doesn't happen and doesn't exist is foolish. And it could be a teaching moment. Like, I remember watching your discussions that you had with the guys about Ferguson, and my son Alex. I made him watch it with me. And, you know, because no one else, he may not hear that anywhere else, because that's what he's watching a lot of right now. So I want the information to come to him, and it doesn't, no matter what vessel it comes through, if it's inside the NBA, great. You know, I mean, I just think sports has a, almost a bit of a duty or a calling at times to do that kind of thing. So I thought it was really great.
Yeah. I see what you mean, Paul. And I think that, you know, and I've heard people say, hey, look, I'm turning on sports so I don't have to hear about that stuff. And what do you guys know about that? So why should we care what you think?
Right.
But look, if the country's talking about it, if the guys who are working at Home Depot are talking about it, and the guys who are working at IBM are talking about it, or AT&T are talking about it, why can't the guys at our work talk about it?
Right.
And I think that's, you know, as long as we don't lose sight of why we are supposed to be there. But I think also, you know, Charles changed the landscape of shows like ours when he came on in 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, part of his deal was, you know, I like to talk about that stuff. I'm opinionated. I've always been that way. That's how he always was. And so it really benefited our show in that regard, too, that we kind of now had a license because of Charles' influence on that to say, yeah, let's talk about it. Let's go there. And as long as you're in tune with it. And you're not just going to say, oh, 2 minutes before air, oh, by the way, we're going to talk about this right. social issue right now. Okay, right. I'll wing something.
No.
I mean, and it is, you know, it is an unscripted conversation. It's unrehearsed, but it behooves you to know the facts and not just get on there and just right. and just yap.
You know,
so that's important.
Absolutely. And I go on MSNBC, CNN, Fox News as one of these commentators, you know, and I try to bring, like we've done with the Daily Show and over the years and the Colbert Report, sort of, you know, I think a comedian's role can be important. You know, it goes back to Will Rogers and Mort Saul and sort of the truth tellers, you know, the ones mm-hmm. that have no skin in the game other than sort of the best interests of everybody at heart. And so right now on most of these panels, most of the time, it's people with agendas on the left and the right, and there's six talking points and they're yelling at each other and no one wants to admit that the other person could possibly be right. Yeah. And there's not really a conversation. It has a semblance. It's almost like that thing in Russia. It looks like a talk show and it looks like information is being imparted onto the viewer, but really it's a PR campaign for the two sides to sit there, and they're not. And so I go on and sort of be the guy that go, hey, wait a minute. I was on a panel and there was an African-American gentleman, he's conservative, and Obama had said that the Constitution was a flawed document. Well, this network liked to beat up Obama. So they would find any little thing and then just seize on it, right? Oh, well, he's our president. He shouldn't talk about the Constitution. Now, I was a lawyer in my previous life before I left to do what I do now. And I said, well, hello, I raised my hand. Boy, I'm like, it kind of is a flawed document. The founders wrote that. They said that they wanted it to be a living, breathing document. It was amended 27 times. Maybe that's a hint that it's a flawed. And the African-American guy goes, yes, it's perfect as it's written. And I just instinctually blurted out, you can't say that. Based on the Constitution as written, you're a torso. You're 3/5 a person right now sitting here. And he looked at me and he wouldn't even acknowledge the color of his own skin vis-a-vis this political conversation. So when a guy like you can bring up something in a heartfelt way, that's more impactful, or at least as impactful as some of these talking heads who aren't really saying anything.
Yeah. And I think what was important that night too is, you know, the election night I wasn't trying to tell anybody what they should do
right.
or how they should do it. It was just, this is how I processed it.
Yeah.
And you know what? I felt sometimes it's cathartic to do something like that. Sometimes mm-hmm. you're looking around the world, Paul, and you're like, man, how do you make sense of any of this that's going on? Yeah. And then to be able to just verbalize it is helpful, and then to have an exchange of ideas, and you may hear something from, you know, from Kenny or Chuck or Shaq that makes you think, and it really is just kind of a four guys sitting around talking, and I think we've been able to do that. I one of the favorite shows we do every year is on the MLK Day, because we've done that at the Center for Civil and Human Rights. We've done it from the King Center.
Yeah,
you know, we've had John Lewis and Bernice King on that before. We had one of the Freedom Riders on last year, and we could have forgotten about the basketball game that night. You know, we did an hour long pregame show. We could have sat there and talked to this guy for hours.
Yeah, I saw it. It was great
about what it was like to ride that bus and to see the hate firsthand. And I think we're doing something beyond basketball and something that does educate. And so, yeah. You know, if your son's watching that show, you know, before a basketball game's on, I'm sure he's saying, I didn't know that. And I'm sure there were adults out there too who were saying, I had no idea. Hmm. And so then you kind of feel like, hey, that was a good show.
Well, that's why I say I really mean it. I think it's the best show, one of the best shows on television, because it's entertaining, it's informative on a sports side. The relationship that you guys have and the dynamic that comes through is so clear and so important in broadcasting. It's all the whole difference. It makes all the difference in the world. And I know that to get to that place of unscripted, and to circle back to the book a little bit, you know, Tim Kiley, who's a producer and VP at TNT, had a part in that, because he came to you in the 90s and wanted you to sort of get off prompter more and kind of establish more of a rapport with the colleagues and the people at home. And you you kind of bristled at that in the beginning, and in fact, through a mug that turned into a pretty funny story, which I'd love you to tell people. But it almost is like Tim Kiley is a precursor to this epiphany you had about God at work in your life and sort of and the importance of being unscripted in your life. I'd like just talk about him a little bit.
So Tim Kiley comes down from ESPN, and as he begins to produce our shows at TNT, sometimes I was doing those shows by myself, no studio analysts, no nothing, and just tons of highlights and scores and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of telling me, look, we need to be more up to date. You know, there may be times where you don't actually see the highlight before it airs, and you're going to have to just wing it. And we had a post-game show not long thereafter, and I kind of kicked around the highlights, and it wasn't my best effort, and I was frustrated, and he and I talked after the show, and it was a discussion in the control room, and then it moved out in the hallway, and then we moved down toward my office, and it snaked through the bathroom where I was going to rinse out this coffee mug, and we were getting kind of heated, and then I wound up throwing the mug against the wall, and it shattered into about a billion pieces. And I left that night. I went back home, and I had to come in the next day for a show. And on my desk that next day is a box, and it's wrapped. And I open it up, and it's a coffee mug that has a want ad on it that said "postal worker needed." And it was, and I was like, this guy is something else. He took this kind of heated moment that we had, turned it completely around, and he really did turn my way of thinking about how I did my job around. And it really was more of an, hey, you don't have to stick to the script. Be yourself, and let's go, and let's be up to date, and this will get your blood pumping a little bit. And he was right. And then, as we added people like Kenny Smith, like Charles, like Shaq, that whole letter rip, unrehearsed, spontaneous vibe, that's what took over. I mean, the first show we ever did, Charles came out for halftime and asked Kenny, what are you going to say about this? And Kenny said, you'll find out. And that set the stage for it, where, we're not going to sit around and rehearse a segment three times so that everybody knows when they laugh or when they react or any of that. It's a free-for-all.
Yeah, well, you are, to steal from Reggie Jackson, the straw that stirs the drink, because, well, Kenny the Jet, he likens you to the Angelo Dundee managing prize fighters. Barkley calls you an orchestra conductor, and Shaq has called you the Dr. J, just graceful. I call you, I'll turn this car around right now, because...
because I haven't heard that one.
Well, I'm a big fan of human behavior, and I watch you, and I can see three Hall of Famers or two, and just these are big stars with big egos, and you manage it. But then every once in a while, one of them crosses the line, and you give them that look, and you go, okay. And then you lean toward the prompter, and you throw it a commercial, and it's like, oh, Dad just kind of took a swat back in the back seat and told them all to. I'm telling you, you're the I'll turn this car around right now. That's who you,
you know what, that's funny because a lot of times the thing that the term that people use is traffic cop on that show, and I said, look, I'm the rogue traffic cop, man. I said, a good traffic cop in New York City doesn't want any fender benders in his intersection, doesn't right. want anybody, to hit. I said, I'm the rogue traffic cop. I'm waving Kenny into the intersection knowing full well that Shaq is going to broadside him.
Yeah,
and I'm just going to sit there and smile. If I were an actual traffic cop, I'd be on administrative duty or on the desk job. They would take me off the street.
Oh, well, it's just, that's when my son and I have some of the most fun moments because, you can see, every once in a while, Shaq will go, yeah, I'll fight you right now. And my son and I, think, I know they wrestled in the grooming room. There was that moment. The way that he races after Kenny, tries to beat him to the big screen. This is just, none of it feels fake in a business where they want you to make it fit. Everybody, let's, like you said, structure it and plan it and script it and whatever. And it's just, and I just watch you. it is so hard what you do, and you do it so, so well, because you're dealing with three children who are brilliant at what they do and entertaining, and you don't get in their way. People need to really watch you and how good you are at what you do. It's very hard.
Well, you're very kind, but I think what makes it work is really we all know our roles, and that's,
yes,
you know, I know my role, and the guys know theirs as the guys who played the game and have been in every conceivable basketball situation. Mm-hmm. And there are times where you let them go, and there are times where I've heard it a million times before. It was so funny during the playoffs. People made a big deal about Shaq and Chuck going at each other one night about, well, there's going to be some furniture moving. Well, you eat too much. Well, go have another donut. Well, and it was like, have you guys not been watching the show for the last 6 years? I said, I hear this 50 times a season. Yeah. I said, so no, I'm not concerned that furniture is going to move. I'm not concerned that anyone's going to throw it at anybody else. I said, that's what they do.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just get like, it's like I went in my nothing box, and I just, you know, it's like you're hearing all this in the car, and the kids are going back and forth in the back seat, and you're just saying, just drive straight ahead.
We're almost there. You're humming your favorite tune in your head just to get through.
Rest area 4 miles ahead. Great.
Yeah. But the thing is, you don't hide that either. Like, I see that on your face. I see, like, or sometimes you go, all right, here we go again. And like, you know, or when Shaq goes after Charles for repeating himself 8 times, you just said the same thing 6 times. You could have said it in 2 minutes instead of 4.
which he does,
you know.
But he always prefaces it with, and first of all, even though it may be the 4th time he said it.
Right, right.
Because you got to remember, first of all, no, this is like 8th of all at this point.
I think it's a little bit, and I love her and she's great, but he's drinking a little bit from the Rachel Maddow cup, who like has to explain things 4 times to you to get. So there's this truck, right? And the trucks are built in Detroit. And Detroit's a city in Michigan. So the truck is built, and it's like, just say it's a truck and let's get to the rest of it. It's just, now your dad, there's a quote from your dad that is a really cool line that I probably am going to use on my son, which is, he said to you, if someone spikes you at second base, you never rub.
Yeah.
And, I think I know what that means, but what was the reason for him to even say that to you, and how do you live your life based on that quote?
That was his, you know, he'd watch me. I think the first time it was brought up is when he was watching me play, going up through high school and that kind of thing, where, you know, something would happen on the field. And if, you know, maybe I paid it a little more attention than I should have in the course of a game, you know, if somebody went in hard on you on second base and then you took a knee and then you didn't get up for a minute, and it's like, you know, he'd be driving home, dad say, hey, Ernie, you never rub. He said, you know, don't let those guys think they hurt you. Don't let anybody think that you're, you know, weaker. You know, I said, you know, you don't rub. Even if it hurts, don't rub.
Yeah.
And so that really came, you know, that was, he displayed that too, just in the business, because it can be a cruel business. You know, people can say things or write things, or, you know, even your coworkers can rub you the wrong way, but he never let anybody know that it was bugging him. It was like, I'm not going to rub.
Well, it's very powerful. My mother told me that. I remember coming home, I don't know, elementary school, you know, kids pick on each other, and this one kid was really bothering me. It might have been middle school, whatever. And she goes, look, ignore him. I go, what? She goes, ignore him. I go, what do you mean? She goes, the worst thing you can do to somebody is ignore them, because most people want some kind of attention and acknowledgement. And if you're talking about a bully, especially, they want that. But if you just basically take them out of your life, you ignore them, they want to get a rise out of you. It takes all the power away. And I never, in sort of researching this and thinking about the quote, just in talking with you now, it just hit me that it feels kind of similar in sort of the sentiment, you know?
Yeah, don't give somebody the satisfaction of saying, yeah, I heard him.
Yeah.
especially, especially in the job that we do, when that's higher profile, and somebody out there, it's going to elevate them somehow to say, yeah, I tweeted this or I wrote this and the guy responded, so I know I struck a nerve, and, my dad would, back in the days of fan mail before any of this social media, back when you actually had to put a stamp on a letter and send it to somebody, he'd send them some mail criticizing him, and my dad would just get one of those Braves postcards that had him and Pete Van Wieren and Skip Carey on it and turn it over and say, hey, glad you're listening to Braves broadcast, go Braves, thanks. and you could just picture this guy in Chattanooga getting this back and saying, doggone it.
Right.
He was nice to me.
Right. Looking up at the sky going, damn you, Johnson.
You gotta kill him with kindness.
Yeah.
You don't rub and you kill him with kindness.
Well, but you say that there was a time, I'm quoting you, there was a time I worshiped at the altar of Rudy. Is it Martz? Am I pronouncing that right?
Rudy Martzke.
I tried to find the pronunciation and I couldn't, but he was a longtime critic for USA Today.
He was the guy. Yeah.
And I know what you mean. Like, there are certain people whose opinion really matters. And I imagine once you found sort of this better way to live your life through God and faith, and that the weight of someone like a Rudy probably left your shoulders, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it was... because it was crazy. I had gone, I'd been in local TV up until I signed with Turner. So in the 80s, I'm doing local TV in Atlanta. And
yeah, you talk about you'd cover a double homicide, and then you were covering doing some other lighter news. Like, it was just...
Oh, well, yeah, in Macon. I mean, when I started out anchoring the news in Macon, I'm doing commercials and the news, so and it was everything you were taught in J school. This is, you don't do this, okay? This is, you're above all of that. But instead, when you're in Macon and you're making very little money, and they don't have the budget for multiple people to do this, so I'm talking about a homicide in Middle Georgia, and then we go to commercial break, and I've got a flannel shirt on, and I'm trying to sell windows and doors at W Supply. So, but when I get to Atlanta, and I'm still doing news and then sports, you don't have to worry about that conflict and that kind of thing. But there were a couple of writers, I guess, in local TV, but it wasn't anything big where there was always this attention to, here's what happened on the air and here's this guy. And, so then when I go to Turner, suddenly I'm in this environment where the national publications are talking about what we do on the air every night, and it's like, oh, really? So this is how this Rudy Martzke guy kind of holds the hammer, huh? And
wow.
So, you'd say something on the air on Friday night and say, man, I hope Rudy heard that. And so that Monday morning with his superlatives, he'd say line of the week, Ernie Johnson said this. Or if you made a mistake, you were like, oh man, I hope he wasn't watching. It'll be the dreaded glitch.
Yeah.
And so it really did get to that point where everything I was thinking about was, how's Rudy going to like it?
Yeah.
And it's like, I got to get out of this mentality.
No,
Rudy's a good enough guy, and I've known him for ages, but
yeah.
And I said, I can't let what one person's going to write, dictate the mood I'm going to be in.
I used to do that, I'd come off of one of these panel shows I talked about, and I immediately checked Twitter, and I really nailed this one. And then it'd be like, oh, okay, some nice stuff. And then over time, just people get mean on Twitter and whatever. And then my wife's like, why? And then I would respond every once in a while. My wife's like, why are you even looking at that? And I go, you're right.
And my but it's hard was, to break.
Yeah,
Paul.
I know. It really is. I mean, we're in a business. It's called show business, and we're on-air talent. Let's be honest. We care about what people think about us. I mean, come on. I mean, and to make that separation is very hard.
No, and it's, and I think... Twitter to me, it could be awesome. It could really be a great thing.
It's very powerful,
you live it, you use it in a positive way, you can get your message out to millions of people. And it's, and I think too many people use it the other way. So I'm going to throw some of my A material out here, and hopefully I can eviscerate this guy.
Yeah.
And it's like, why do you want to do that?
Yeah.
You know, when you think about other ways it could be used, it could be so much more beneficial.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, we're looking at a president who uses it, in all the wrong ways.
Yeah. To me, it's exactly that. Like you said, you can really sort of have some pot, but I think it's people that don't have a platform and they're like, hey, wait, I can kind of be like a celebrity too.
I do have a platform.
Right.
And look, this guy responded to it because he had his feelings hurt.
Yeah.
Ah, I did it.
Exactly. You know? And I always tell my son Alex, I say, look, one of the worst things in the world is power in the hands of people who have never had it or don't know how to respect it. And there's a lot of power in Twitter. Those 840 characters can really devastate. It's so funny, you know, I very rarely went back, and somebody just, I did one of these appearances, and they were just, it was over the top nasty, and I wrote back, and I responded back in a pretty intense fashion, and everybody came to this person's defense and go, boy, that was a little harsh. I go, what are you talking about? and then I got into this dialogue with a couple of other Twitter followers, and I go, well, now she understands. Now she understands what it's like to put yourself out there, which is what she did and really in a cruel way criticizing me, and then having someone respond to it. You expose yourself. So maybe she'll remember next time when someone is putting themselves out there to be a little more kind. Look, you don't have to love me. You don't have to like me, but there's a line. You can just say, hey, you know, I don't agree with you, or here's another way to look at stuff. And it was just, but it was ironic to me that suddenly, and then I unfollowed her and I blocked her. And then another follower who is a friend goes, she's upset and crying. Could you please unblock her and follow her? She's sorry. I'm like, what am I in high school? What is this?
And then you say, what kind of a world are we living in? What is going on here? No, it's you're absolutely right. And I just, man, it could be such a good vehicle for encouragement and everything else, but that's not the way a lot of folks view it.
Hey, before we wrap up, I just want to talk for a second about adopting Michael, your son, and he has MS, and it really struck me how I was so impressed with this on so many levels, but it's so selfless and not something that I could do. My wife and I have our son, Alex, and then we're trying to have a second one, and she got diagnosed with AFib, which is a pretty serious heart condition. And the doctor said, you know, why aren't you trying to have another kid? That could be really risky. You know, your wife could go into stroke during pregnancy, during childbirth, etc. And so then someone said, well, what would you think about adopting? And we didn't. And part of it for me was, I don't know that I could love that child the way I could love my biological child. I assume that that's not the case, but did that cross your mind for you? Not because Michael has MS or anything, just adopting a child in general is something I could never get my head around.
Well, you know, that's the thing. You know, if I go back to this scripted and unscripted theme, you know, we were kind of living the script, me and Cheryl, and we had Eric and Maggie, so we had a boy and a girl, and it was like, let's just stick to the script. And then she was so moved, Cheryl was so moved by the ABC News 2020 story about the Romanian orphans back in 1991, that she came to me with this idea, and it was like, hey, she said, you know, what would you think about adopting one of these kids out of this Romanian orphanage? And so that's the decision that we made. And to tell you the truth, I had no idea how I would.
At that point, you're like,
gee,
you must have been thinking at that point, you must have been going, boy, I thought you were just going to bring me back a T-shirt from Romania. I didn't think you were going to bring me back a baby.
And so the thing is, I think what it teaches you is that you have no idea what the capacity of the human heart has for love. Because as soon as I laid eyes on this boy, when she got off the flight from Romania, it was like, here's my son.
Wow.
I think it's a legit question that you have is, you know, if he's, you know, if it's a child not born to you and your wife, you know, will you, And you will. I mean, that's the deal. I mean, we've adopted four kids after we had Eric and Maggie. And so, I think we really underestimate the capacity of the human heart to love beyond what we are right now. There's like this unlimited room. And so, in Michael's case with muscular dystrophy, you know, look, he's already a miracle. I mean, he's 28 years old now. I mean, a lot of families know that a lot of kids don't get out of their teens when you have what he has. And so, it's a very special thing. And what was really cool was that our first two kids, our biological kids, never made a distinction about, but well, Michael's adopted. He's not. I mean, yeah, we adopted him, but he's your brother. All right.
And
that was it. It was like Cheryl had gone 9 months and gone to the hospital and came back with Michael.
Well, you know, and the compassion that I didn't realize this until I was reading more about you is that the compassion that you teach your children is so amazing. There's this little story. I guess Michael can't swallow, but he can taste. So Eric, your son, takes him to get French fries and dips the French fry in ketchup and then puts it in his mouth, and at least he can taste the taste of fry and ketchup.
Yeah.
And I mean, unless you adopted that kid, I don't know that you could teach your son Eric that level of compassion, you know, through a conversation or having him read a book or something like that.
As I said, Michael's 28, he was 3 when we adopted him. So we're 25 years of kind of this new normal in the house. And so I think what it's taught all of us is that, I mean, there's no way to put yourself first in our household. There's always somebody to serve. And I think that was the cool thing. I mean, and Eric told me that one, you know, a few months ago, and I said, where'd you take Michael for lunch today when you were out? And he said, we went to Ted's Montana Grill. Said, well, he wasn't able to have much. He says, I actually got the fries and dipped them in ketchup, and he held it in his mouth for just a second to get the taste, and then we just went through a pile of fries that way.
And it really makes you
sit back and it kind of buckles your knees, and you're kind of saying, man, that's, you know, it's a 32-year-old son who gets it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other thing, too, is sort of the piece that ESPN did on you that Jeremy Schapp did is so wonderful, and you get up so early, and you bathe Michael, and you take him to car shows. He loves cars. But these people, you need to normalize them. Like, people want to avert their eyes from people who are in wheelchairs or disabled a lot of times. Like, when I'm performing stand up, I will, if I see somebody in a wheelchair, I'm immediate, not someone who broke their ankle and they're in a wheelchair, but you know what I'm like in Michael's situation, I will talk to them. And there was a guy, he was with 3 buddies and he's got a big shawl on, he had MS, he had the tube, you know, the ventilator into the throat and everything. And I'm on stage and I'm looking at this guy and I'm like, I got to talk to this guy because I don't think people really engage these people a lot. You know, they don't want to know, it's uncomfortable, they can't. So I start talking to the guy with MS. I go, how you doing? He goes, good. I go, you got MS? He goes, yeah. I go, you're out with your friends? Yeah. And pardon me, this is going to get slightly blue, but I got to tell you. I go, I was curious about something, and this is honestly the way my brain works. I go, can you still get an erection? And he goes, you damn right! And the whole place went crazy. And then I go, and he was drinking. I go, you want to have a drink? And so I bought him a drink, and I go, now don't spill it because you have MS. Don't start. He starts laughing and the crowd's laughing. And then I go, what's going on with your shawl? He had a shawl on and there was like a little hole in the right bottom corner of the shawl. He goes, why? I go, it looks really disgusting and ratty. I go, how'd that hole happen? I go, let me guess, the small front wheel of your wheelchair got caught and it called. How did you know that? He's going crazy. And I said to his friends, I go, you 3 stiffs, you can't go to Marshall's and drop $50 between the 3 of you and buy this guy a shawl. So there's a guy sitting down front with a cowboy boots on. I go, take your boot off. He goes, what? I go, take your boot off. And I took his cowboy boot and I walked around the showroom and I had people put money in the boot. And then I dumped the money on the guy in the wheelchair. He's come back 3 times to see me. His friend said, no, now I'm not, this isn't to be self-aggrandizing, but his friend said, nobody talks to him like that. They don't want to be treated any differently. You talk to them the way you would talk to anybody. They want to be included and not be excluded in terms of people's interaction with them.
No, I'm with you 100%, and I think it's not something that you have to tiptoe around. You know, we don't expect people to.
Yeah.
The worst thing is just staring.
Yes.
You know, the worst thing, you know, and I especially deal with that with kids. And especially, you know, smaller kids who you'll be in the mall and a kid will just cannot take his eyes off. He's looking at what's up with the blue tube, what's up with the oxygen tank, what's up with the machine and the wheelchair. And those are the, I love to engage those kids. I said, hey, this is Michael. You know, he can't really breathe on his own, but this machine helps him breathe.
Yeah.
And this wheelchair goes pretty fast. And he's, you know what, and here's the message. Nobody. We don't all have to play by the same rules.
Yeah.
You know, we've all got some stuff, and so this is how he gets around. You're able to get around that way, but that's it. So sometimes, if you know what the situation is, then it's not a curiosity. Then it's not a stare at the kid in the chair.
Yeah.
And I know exactly what that feels like. And I think the only time you really want a little consideration that way or a little sensitivity on it, and my pet peeve is people who use the handicap spots who don't need them, you know, because you're driving around with a van with a ramp and you can't get in that because somebody's parked in there, and then you talk to them and say, hey, look, you know, it really is, you know, we need this space so the ramp goes down so that I can get my son out. He's in a wheelchair. Well, I'm just going to be in here for a minute.
Oh,
and it's like, oh, you just don't just.
You don't get it.
Yeah, you don't get it. Do you have a 10-year-old I could explain this to who might be a little more sensitive to it?
Oh, God. Well, I got to tell you, what you and your wife have done in adopting these kids, amazing. And you're at the top of your game, and I can't tell you what a treat it is. I was very excited. My son, you were very nice. People should know, Ernie signed a book to my son. He's read it. He really loved it. It's a great book. It's unscripted, the unpredictable moments that make life extraordinary. And it really, really, I don't use this word a lot, but it's really exciting and a big honor to have you on. And I just think you're terrific. So thank you.
Oh, what a huge pleasure for me, man. It's a wonderful conversation. And it could go on for hours as far as I'm concerned. But I appreciate you.
I know your time is tight, but you know what? We'll reserve another time down the road and have you back on, because I want to just talk to you about the nuts and bolts of broadcasting. I could talk about that forever, but maybe we'll do another one. I'd love to have you on again sometime.
Oh, without question, man. Without question.
Okay. Well, this is Ernie Johnson. Thanks for checking out the podcast, everybody. We'll see you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.